strange, lonely place. She begged, "Who are you, sufferer, that speak the truth to one who suffers?" And he answered, "You see Prometheus, who gave mortals fire." She knew him then and his story. "You, he who succored the whole race of men? You, that Prometheus, the daring, the enduring?" They talked freely to each other. He told her how Zeus had treated him, and she told him that Zeus was the reason why she, once a princess and a happy girl, had been changed into a beast, a starving beast, that frenzied runs with clumsy leaps and bounds. Oh, shame. Zeus's jealous wife, Hera, was the direct cause of her misfortunes, but back of them all was Zeus himself. He fell in love with her, and sent, "Ever to my maiden chamber, visions of the night, persuading me with gentle words, 'Oh, happy, happy girl, why are you all too long a maid? The arrow of desire has pierced Zeus, for you he is on fire. With you it is his will to capture love. Always, each night, such dreams possessed me.'" But still greater than Zeus's love was his fear of Hera's jealousy. He acted, however, with very little wisdom for the father of gods and men, when he tried to hide Io and himself by wrapping the earth in a cloud so thick and dark that a sudden night seemed to drive the clear daylight away. Hera knew perfectly well that there was a reason for this odd occurrence, and instantly suspected her husband. When she could not find him anywhere in heaven, she glided swiftly down to the earth and ordered the cloud off. But Zeus, too, had been quick. As she caught sight of him, he was standing beside a most lovely white heifer. Io, of course. He swore that he had never seen her until just now, when she had sprung forth, newborn, from the earth. "And this," Ovid says, "shows that the lies lovers tell do not anger the gods. However, it also shows that they are not very useful, for Hera did not believe a word of it. She said the heifer was very pretty, and would Zeus please make her a present of it?" Sorry as he was, he saw at once that to refuse would give the whole thing away. What excuse could he make? An insignificant little cow. He turned Io reluctantly over to his wife, and Hera knew very well how to keep her away from him. She gave her into the charge of Argus, an excellent arrangement for Hera's purpose, since Argus had 100 eyes. Before such a watchman, who could sleep with some of the eyes and keep on guard with the rest, Zeus seemed helpless. He watched Io's misery, turned into a beast, driven from her home. He dared not come to her help. At last, however, he went to his son Hermes, the messenger of the gods, and told him he must find a way to kill Argus. There was no god cleverer than Hermes. As soon as he had sprung to earth from heaven, he laid aside everything that marked him as a god and approached Argus like a country fellow, playing very sweetly upon a pipe of reeds. Argus was pleased at the sound and called to the musician to come nearer.
"You might as well sit by me on this rock," he said. "You see, it's shady, just right for shepherds."
Nothing could have been better for Hermes' plan, and yet nothing happened. He played, and then he talked on and on, as drowsily and monotonously as he could. Some of the 100 eyes would go to sleep, but some were always awake. At last, however, one story was successful, about the god Pan, how he loved a nymph named Syrinx, who fled from him, and just as he was about to seize her, was turned into a tuft of reeds by her sister nymphs. Pan said, "Still, you shall be mine," and he made, from what she had become, a shepherd's pipe of reeds with beeswax joined. The little story does not seem especially tiresome, as such stories go, but Argus found it so. All of his eyes went to sleep.
Hermes killed him at once, of course, but Hera took the eyes and set them in the tail of the peacock, her favorite bird. It seemed then that Io was free, but no. Hera at once turned on her again. She sent a gadfly to plague her, which stung her to madness. Io told Prometheus, "He drives me all along the long sea strand. I may not stop for food or drink. He will not let me sleep." Prometheus tried to comfort her, but he could point her only to the distant future. What lay immediately before her was still more wandering and in fearsome lands. To be sure, the part of the sea she first ran along in her frenzy would be called Ionian after her, and the Bosphorus, which means the ford of the cow, would preserve the memory of when she went through it. But her real consolation must be that at long last she would reach the Nile, where Zeus would restore her to her human form. She would bear him a son named Epiphus, and live forever after happy and honored. And know this, that from your race will spring one glorious with the bow, bold-hearted, and he shall set me free. Io's descendant would be Hercules, greatest of heroes, than whom hardly the gods were greater, and to whom Prometheus would owe his freedom. Europa. This story, so like the Renaissance idea of the classical, fantastic, delicately decorated, bright-colored, is taken entirely from a poem of the 3rd-century Alexandrian poet Moschus, by far the best account of it. Io was not the only girl who gained geographical fame because Zeus fell in love with her. There was another, known far more widely, Europa, the daughter of the king of Sidon. But whereas the wretched Io had to pay dearly for the distinction, Europa was exceedingly fortunate. Except for a few moments of terror when she found herself crossing the deep sea on the back of a bull, she did not suffer at all. The story does not say what Hera was about at the time, but it is clear that she was off guard, and her husband free to do as he pleased. Up in heaven one spring morning, as he idly watched the earth, Zeus suddenly saw a charming spectacle. Europa had waked early, troubled just as Io had been by a dream, only this time not of a god who loved her, but of two continents, who, each in the shape of a woman, tried to possess her. Asia, saying that she had given her birth and therefore owned her, and the other, as yet nameless, declaring that Zeus would give the maiden to her. Once awake from this strange vision, which had come at dawn, the time when true dreams oftenest visit mortals, Europa decided not to try to go to sleep again, but to summon her companions, girls born in the same year as herself and all of noble birth, to go out with her to the lovely, blooming meadows near the sea. Here was their favorite meeting place, whether they wanted to dance or bathe their fair bodies at the river mouth or gather flowers. This time all had brought baskets, knowing that the flowers were now at their perfection. Europa's was of gold, exquisitely chased with figures which showed, oddly enough, the story of Io, her journeys in the shape of a cow, the death of Argus, and Zeus lightly touching her with his divine hand and changing her back into a woman. It was, as may be perceived, a marvel worth gazing upon, and had been made by no less a personage than Hephaestus, the celestial workman of Olympus. Lovely as the basket was, there were flowers as lovely to fill it with, sweet-smelling narcissus, and hyacinths, and violets, and yellow crocus, and most radiant of all, the crimson splendor of the wild rose. The girls gathered them delightedly, wandering here and there over the meadow, each one a maiden fairest among the fair. Yet even so, Europa shone out among them as the goddess of love outshines the sister graces.
And it was that very goddess of love who brought about what next happened. As Zeus in heaven watched the pretty scene, she who alone can conquer Zeus, along with her son, the mischievous boy Cupid, shot one of her shafts into his heart. And that very instant, he fell madly in love with Europa. Even though Hera was away, he thought it well to be cautious, and before appearing to Europa, he changed himself into a bull. Not such a one as you might see in a stall or grazing in a field, but one beautiful beyond all bulls that ever were, bright chestnut in color, with a silver circle on his brow and horns like the crescent of the young moon. He seemed so gentle, as well as so lovely, that the girls were not frightened at his coming, but gathered around to caress him and to breathe the heavenly fragrance that came from him, sweeter even than that of the flowery meadow. It was Europa he drew toward, and as she gently touched him, he lowed so musically, no flute could give forth a more melodious sound. Then he lay down before her feet and seemed to show her his broad back, and she cried to the others to come with her and mount him. "For surely he will bear us on his back. He is so mild and dear and gentle to behold. He is not like a bull, but like a good, true man, except he cannot speak." Smiling, she sat down on his back, but the others, quick though they were to follow her, had no chance. The bull leaped up, and at full speed, rushed to the seashore and then, not into but over the wide water. As he went, the waves grew smooth before him, and a whole procession rose up from the deep and accompanied him. The strange sea gods, Nereids riding upon dolphins, and Tritons blowing their horns, and the mighty master of the sea himself, Zeus's own brother. Europa, frightened equally by the wondrous creatures she saw and the moving waters all around, clung with one hand to the bull's great horn, and with the other caught up her purple dress to keep it dry, and the winds swelled out the deep folds even as a sail swells on a ship, and ever gently thus they wafted her. No bull could this be, thought Europa, but most certainly a god. And she spoke pleadingly to him, begging him to pity her and not leave her in some strange place all alone. He spoke to her in answer, and showed her she had guessed rightly what he was. She had no cause to fear, he told her. He was Zeus, greatest of gods, and all he was doing was from love of her. He was taking her to Crete, his own island, where his mother had hidden him from Cronus when he was born, and there she would bear him glorious sons whose scepters shall hold sway over all men on earth. Everything happened, of course, as Zeus had said. Crete came into sight. They landed, and the Seasons, the gatekeepers of Olympus, arrayed her for her bridal. Her sons were famous men, not only in this world, but in the next, where two of them, Minos and Rhadamanthus, were rewarded for their justice upon the earth by being made the judges of the dead. But her own name remains the best known of all. The Cyclops Polyphemus. The first part of this story goes back to the Odyssey. The second part is told only by the 3rd century Alexandrian poet Theocritus. The last part could have been written by no one except the satirist Lucian in the 2nd century AD. At least 1,000 years separate the beginning from the end. Homer's vigor and power of storytelling, the pretty fancies of Theocritus, the smart cynicism of Lucian, illustrate in their degree the course of Greek literature. All the monstrous forms of life which were first created, the hundred-handed creatures, the giants, and so on, were permanently banished from the earth when they had been conquered, with the single exception of the Cyclopes. They were allowed to come back, and they became, finally, great favorites of Zeus, They were wonderful workmen, and they forged his thunderbolts. At first, there had been only three, but later there were many. Zeus gave them a home in a fortunate country where the vineyards and corn lands, unplowed and unsown, bore fruits plenteously. They had great flocks of sheep and goats as well, and they lived at their ease. Their fierceness and savage temper, however, did not grow less. They had no laws or courts of justice, but each one did as he pleased. It was not a good country for strangers. Ages after Prometheus was punished, when the descendants of the men he helped had grown civilized and had learned to build far-sailing ships, a Greek prince beached his boat on the shore of this dangerous land. His name was Odysseus, Ulysses in Latin, and he was on his way home after the destruction of Troy. In the hardest battle he had fought with the Trojans, he had never come as near to death as he did then. Not far from the spot where his crew had made the vessel fast was a cave, open toward the sea and very lofty. It looked inhabited. There was a strong fence before the entrance. Odysseus started off to explore it with 12 of his men. They were in need of food, and he took with him a goatskin full of very potent and mellow wine to give whoever lived there in return for hospitality. The gate in the fence was not closed, and they made their way into the cave. No one was there, but it was clearly the dwelling of some very prosperous person. Along the sides of the cave were many crowded pens of lambs and kids. Also, there were racks full of cheeses and pails brimming with milk, delightful to the sea-worn travelers who ate and drank as they waited for the master. At last he came, hideous and huge, tall as a great mountain crag. Driving his flock before him, he entered and closed the cave's mouth with a ponderous slab of stone. Then, looking around, he caught sight of the strangers and cried out in a dreadful, booming voice, "Who are you who enter unbidden the house of Polyphemus? Traders or thieving pirates?" They were terror-stricken at the sight and sound of him, but Odysseus made swift to answer, and firmly, too. "Shipwrecked warriors from Troy are we, and your suppliants, under the protection of Zeus, the suppliant's god." But Polyphemus roared out that he cared not for Zeus. He was bigger than any god and feared none of them. With that, he stretched out his mighty arms, and in each great hand he seized one of the men and dashed his brains out on the ground. Slowly, he feasted off them to the last shred, and then, satisfied, stretched himself out across the cavern and slept. He was safe from attack. No one but he could roll back the huge stone before the door, and if the horrified men had been able to summon courage and strength enough to kill him, they would have been imprisoned there forever. During that long, terrible night, Odysseus faced the awful thing that had happened and would happen to every one of them if he could not think out some way of escape. But by the time day had dawned, and the flock gathering at the entrance woke the Cyclops up, no idea at all had come to him. He had to watch two more of his company die, for Polyphemus breakfasted as he had supped. Then he drove out his flock, moving back the big block at the door and pushing it into place again as easily as a man opens and shuts the lid to his quiver. Throughout the day, shut in the cave, Odysseus thought and thought. Four of his men had perished hideously. Must they all go the same dreadful way? At last, a plan shaped itself in his mind. An enormous timber lay near the pens, as long and as thick as the mast of a 20-oared ship. From this, he cut off a good piece, and then he and his men sharpened it and hardened the point by turning it round and round in the fire. They had finished and hidden it by the time the Cyclops came back. There followed the same horrible feast as before. When it was over, Odysseus filled a cup with his own wine that he had brought with him and offered it to the Cyclops. He emptied it with delight and demanded more, and Odysseus poured for him until finally a drunken sleep overcame him. Then Odysseus and his men drew out the great stake from its hiding place and heated the point in the fire until it almost burst into flame. Some power from on high breathed a mad courage into them, and they drove the red-hot spike right into the Cyclops' eye. With an awful scream, he sprang up and wrenched the point out. This way and that he flung around the cavern, searching for his tormentors, but, blind as he was, they were able to slip away from him. At last, he pushed aside the stone at the entrance and sat down there, stretching his arms across, thinking thus to catch them when they tried to get away. But Odysseus had made a plan for this, too. He bade each man choose out 3 thick-fleeced rams and bind them together with strong, pliant strips of bark. Then, to wait for day, when the flock would be sent out to pasture. At last, the dawn came, and as the beasts crowding through the entrance passed out, Polyphemus felt them over to be sure no one carried a man on his back. He never thought to feel underneath. But that was where the men were, each tucked under the middle ram, holding on to the great fleece. Once out of that fearful place, they dropped to the ground and, hurrying to the ship, in no time launched it and were aboard. But Odysseus was too angry to leave in prudent silence. He sent a great shout over the water to the blind giant at the cave's mouth. "So, Cyclops, you were not quite strong enough to eat all of the puny men? You are rightly punished for what you did to those who were guests in your house." The words stung Polyphemus to the heart. Up he sprang and tore a great crag from the mountain and flung it at the ship. It came within a hair's breadth of crushing the prow, and with the backwash the boat was borne landward. The crew put all their strength into their oars and just succeeded in pulling out to sea. When Odysseus saw that they were safely away, he cried again, tauntingly, "Cyclops, Odysseus, wrecker of cities, put out your eye, and do you so tell anyone who asks." But they were too far off by then. The giant could do nothing. He sat blinded on the shore. This was the only story told about Polyphemus for many years. Centuries passed, and he was still the same, a frightful monster, shapeless, huge, his eye put out. But finally he changed, as what is ugly and evil is apt to change and grow milder with time. Perhaps some storyteller saw the helpless, suffering creature Odysseus left behind as a thing to be pitied. At all events, the next story about him shows him in a very pleasing light, not terrifying at all, but a most poor, credulous monster, a most ridiculous monster. Quite aware of how hideous and uncouth and repulsive he was, and therefore wretched, because he was madly in love with the charming, mocking sea nymph Galatea. By this time, the place where he lived was Sicily, and he had somehow got his eye back, perhaps by some miracle of his father, who in this story is Poseidon, the great god of the sea. The lovelorn giant knew Galatea would never have him. His case was hopeless. And yet, whenever his pain made him harden his heart against her and bid himself, "Milk the ewe you have, why pursue what shuns you?" the minx would come softly stealing near him. Then, suddenly, a shower of apples would pelt his flock, and her voice would ring in his ears, calling him a laggard in love. But no sooner was he up and after her than she would be off, laughing at his slow clumsiness as he tried to follow her. All he could do was again to sit wretched and helpless on the shore. But this time, not trying in fury to kill people, only singing mournful love songs to soften the sea nymph's heart. In a much later story, Galatea turned kind, not because the exquisite, delicate, milk-white maid, as Polyphemus called her in his songs, fell in love with the hideous one-eyed creature. In this tale, too, he has got back his eye. But because she prudently reflected that he was the favored son of the Lord of the Sea, and by no means to be despised. So she told her sister nymph, Doris, who had rather hoped to attract the Cyclops herself, and who began the talk by saying, scornfully, "A fine lover you've got, that Sicilian shepherd. Everybody's talking about it." Galatea, "None of your airs, please. He's the son of Poseidon. There." Doris, "Zeus is, for all I care. One thing's certain, he's an ugly, ill-mannered brute." Galatea, "Just let me tell you, Doris, there's something very manly about him. Of course, it's true he's got only one eye, but he sees as well with it as if he had two." Doris, "It sounds as if you were in love yourself." Galatea, "I? In love? With Polyphemus? Not I. But of course, I can guess why you're talking like this. You know perfectly well he has never noticed you. Only me." Doris, "A shepherd with only one eye thinks you handsome? That's something to be proud of. Anyway, you won't have to cook for him. He can make a very good meal off a traveler, I understand." But Polyphemus never won Galatea. She fell in love with a beautiful young prince named Acis, whom Polyphemus, furiously jealous, killed. However, Acis was changed into a river god, so that story ended well. But we are not told that Polyphemus ever loved any maiden except Galatea, or that any maiden ever loved Polyphemus. Flower myths. Narcissus, Hyacinth, Adonis. The first story about the creation of the Narcissus is told only in an early Homeric hymn of the 7th or 8th century. The second I have taken from Ovid. There is an immense difference between the two poets, who are separated from each other not only by 600 or 700 years, but also by the fundamental difference between the Greek and the Roman. The hymn is written objectively, simply, without a touch of affectation. The poet is thinking of his subject. Ovid is, as always, thinking of his audience. But he tells this story well. The bit about the ghost trying to look at itself in the river of death is a subtle touch which is quite characteristic of him, and quite unlike any Greek writer. Euripides gives the best account of the festival of Hyacinthus. Apollodorus and Ovid both tell his story. Whenever there is any vividness in my narrative, it may be ascribed securely to Ovid. Apollodorus never deviates into anything like that. Adonis I have taken from two third-century poets, Theocritus and Bion. The tale is typical of the Alexandrian poets, tender, a little soft, but always in exquisite taste. In Greece, there are most lovely wildflowers. They would be beautiful anywhere, but Greece is not a rich and fertile country of wide meadows and fruitful fields where flowers seem at home. It is a land of rocky ways and stony hills and rugged mountains, and in such places, the exquisite vivid bloom of the wildflowers, a profusion of delight, gay, bewilderingly bright, comes as a startling surprise. Bleak heights are carpeted in radiant colors. Every crack and crevice of a frowning crag blossoms. The contrast of this laughing, luxuriant beauty with the clear-cut, austere grandeur all around arrests the attention sharply. Elsewhere, wildflowers may be little noticed, but never in Greece. That was as true in the days of old as it is now. In the faraway ages, when the tales of Greek mythology were taking shape, men found the brilliant blossoms of the Greek spring a wonder and a delight. Those people separated from us by thousands of years, and almost completely unknown to us, felt, as we do, before that miracle of loveliness. Each flower so delicate, yet altogether covering the land like a rainbow mantle flung over the hills. The first storytellers in Greece told story after story about them, how they had been created, and why they were so beautiful. It was the most natural thing possible to connect them with the gods. All things in heaven and earth were mysteriously linked with the divine powers, but beautiful things most of all. Often an especially exquisite flower was held to be the direct creation of a god for his own purpose. That was true of the narcissus, which was not like ours of that name, but a lovely bloom of glowing purple and silver. Zeus called it into being to help his brother, the lord of the dark underworld, when he wanted to carry away the maiden he had fallen in love with, Demeter's daughter Persephone. She was gathering flowers with her companions in the Vale of Enna, in a meadow of soft grass and roses and crocus and lovely violets and iris and hyacinths. Suddenly, she caught sight of something quite new to her, a bloom more beautiful by far than any she had ever seen. A strange glory of a flower, a marvel to all, immortal gods and mortal men. 100 blossoms grew up from the roots, and the fragrance was very sweet. The broad sky above and the whole earth laughed to see it, and the salt wave of the sea. Only Persephone among the maidens had spied it. The rest were at the other end of the meadow. She stole toward it, half fearful at being alone, but unable to resist the desire to fill her basket with it, exactly as Zeus had supposed she would feel. Wondering, she stretched out her hands to take the lovely plaything, but before she touched it, a chasm opened in the earth, and out of it, coal-black horses sprang, drawing a chariot and driven by one who had a look of dark splendor, majestic and beautiful and terrible. He caught her to him and held her close. The next moment, she was being borne away from the radiance of earth in springtime to the world of the dead by the king who rules it. This was not the only story about the Narcissus. There was another, as magical but quite different. The hero of it was a beautiful lad whose name was Narcissus. His beauty was so great, all the girls who saw him longed to be his, but he would have none of them. He would pass the loveliest carelessly by, no matter how much she tried to make him look at her. Heartbroken maidens were nothing to him. Even the sad case of the fairest of the nymphs, Echo, did not move him. She was a favorite of Artemis, the goddess of woods and wild creatures, but she came under the displeasure of a still mightier goddess, Hera herself, who was at her usual occupation of trying to discover what Zeus was about. She suspected that he was in love with one of the nymphs, and she went to look them over to try to discover which. However, she was immediately diverted from her investigation by Echo's gay chatter. As she listened, amused, the others silently stole away, and Hera could come to no conclusion as to where Zeus's wandering fancy had alighted. With her usual injustice, she turned against Echo. That nymph became another unhappy girl whom Hera punished. The goddess condemned her never to use her tongue again except to repeat what was said to her. "You will always have the last word," Hera said, "but no power to speak first." This was very hard, but hardest of all when Echo, too, with all the other lovelorn maidens, loved Narcissus. She could follow him, but she could not speak to him. How then could she make a youth who never looked at a girl pay attention to her? One day, however, it seemed her chance had come. He was calling to his companions, "Is anyone here?" And she called back, in rapture, "Here, here." She was still hidden by the trees, so that he did not see her, and he shouted, "Come!" Just what she longed to say to him. She answered joyfully, "Come!" and stepped forth from the woods with her arms outstretched. But he turned away in angry disgust. "Not so," he said. "I will die before I give you power over me." All she could say was, humbly, entreatingly, "I give you power over me."
But he was gone. She hid her blushes and her shame in a lonely cave, and never could be comforted. Still, she lives in places like that, and they say she has so wasted away with longing that only her voice now is left to her. So Narcissus went on his cruel way, a scorner of love. But at last one of those he wounded prayed a prayer, and it was answered by the gods. "May he who loves not others love himself." The great goddess Nemesis, which means righteous anger, undertook to bring this about. As Narcissus bent over a clear pool for a drink, and saw there his own reflection, on the moment he fell in love with it. "Now I know," he cried, "what others have suffered from me, for I burn with love of my own self. And yet, how can I reach that loveliness I see mirrored in the water? But I cannot leave it. Only death can set me free." And so it happened. He pined away, leaning perpetually over the pool, fixed in one long gaze. Echo was near him, but she could do nothing. Only when, dying, he called to his image, "Farewell, farewell," she could repeat the words as a last goodbye to him. They say that when his spirit crossed the river that encircles the world of the dead, it leaned over the boat to catch a final glimpse of itself in the water. The nymphs he had scorned were kind to him in death and sought his body to give it burial, but they could not find it. Where it had lain, there was blooming a new and lovely flower, and they called it by his name, Narcissus. Another flower that came into being through the death of a beautiful youth was the hyacinth. Again, not like the flower we call by that name, but lily-shaped and of a deep purple, or, some say, a splendid crimson. That was a tragic death, and each year it was commemorated by the festival of Hyacinthus that lasts throughout the tranquil night. In a contest with Apollo, he was slain. Discus throwing, they competed, and the god's swift cast sped beyond the goal he aimed at, and struck Hyacinthus full in the forehead, a terrible wound. He had been Apollo's dearest companion. There was no rivalry between them when they tried which could throw the discus farthest. They were only playing a game. The god was horror-struck to see the blood gush forth, and the lad, deathly pale, fall to the ground. He turned as pale himself as he caught him up in his arms and tried to stanch the wound. But it was too late. While he held him, the boy's head fell back as a flower does when its stem is broken. He was dead, and Apollo, kneeling beside him, wept for him, dying so young, so beautiful. He had killed him, although through no fault of his, and he cried, "Oh, if I could give my life for yours, or die with you." Even as he spoke, the blood-stained grass turned green again, and there bloomed forth the wondrous flower that was to make the lad's name known forever. Apollo himself inscribed the petals, some say with Hyacinth's initial, and others with the two letters of the Greek word that means alas. Either way, a memorial of the god's great sorrow. There is a story, too, that Zephyr, the west wind, not Apollo, was the direct cause of the death, that he also loved this fairest of youths, and in his jealous anger at seeing the god preferred to him, he blew upon the discus and made it strike Hyacinth. Such charming tales of lovely young people, who, dying in the springtime of life, were fittingly changed into spring flowers, have, probably, a dark background. They give a hint of black deeds that were done in the far distant past. Long before there were any stories told in Greece, or any poems sung which have come down to us, perhaps even before there were storytellers and poets, it might happen,
if the fields around a village were not fruitful, if the corn did not spring up as it should, that one of the villagers would be killed, and his or her blood sprinkled over the barren land. There was no idea as yet of the radiant gods of Olympus who would have loathed the hateful sacrifice. Mankind had only a dim feeling that as their own life depended utterly on seed time and harvest, there must be a deep connection between themselves and the earth, and that their blood, which was nourished by the corn, could in turn nourish it at need. What more natural, then, if a beautiful boy had thus been killed, than to think, when later the ground bloomed with narcissus or hyacinths, that the flowers were his very self, changed and yet living again. So they would tell each other it had happened, a lovely miracle which made the cruel death seem less cruel. Then, as the ages passed and people no longer believed that the earth needed blood to be fruitful, all that was cruel in the story would be dropped and in the end forgotten. No one would remember that terrible things had once been done. Hyacinthus, they would say, died not slaughtered by his kinsfolk to get food for them, but only because of a sorrowful mistake. Of these deaths and flowery resurrections, the most famous was that of Adonis. Every year the Greek girls mourned for him, and every year they rejoiced when his flower, the blood-red anemone, the wind flower, was seen blooming again. Aphrodite loved him. The goddess of love, who pierces with her shafts the hearts of gods and men alike, was fated herself to suffer that same piercing pain. She saw him when he was born, and even then loved him, and decided he should be hers. She carried him to Persephone to take charge of him for her. But Persephone loved him too, and would not give him back to Aphrodite, not even when the goddess went down to the underworld to get him. Neither goddess would yield, and finally, Zeus himself had to judge between them. He decided that Adonis should spend half the year with each, the autumn and winter with the queen of the dead, the spring and summer with the goddess of love and beauty. All the time he was with Aphrodite, she sought only to please him. He was keen for the chase, and often she would leave her swan-drawn car, in which she was used to glide at her ease through the air, and follow him along rough woodland ways dressed like a huntress. But one sad day she happened not to be with him, and he tracked down a mighty boar. With his hunting dogs he brought the beast to bay. He hurled his spear at it, but he only wounded it, and before he could spring away, the boar, mad with pain, rushed at him and gored him with its great tusks. Aphrodite, in her winged car high over the earth, heard her lover's groan and flew to him. He was softly breathing his life away, the dark blood flowing down his skin of snow and his eyes growing heavy and dim. She kissed him, but Adonis knew not that she kissed him as he died. Cruel as his wound was, the wound in her heart was deeper. She spoke to him, although she knew he could not hear her. "You die, O thrice desired, and my desire has flown like a dream. Gone, with you, is the girdle of my beauty, but I myself must live, who am a goddess, and may not follow you. Kiss me yet once again, the last long kiss, until I draw your soul within my lips and drink down all your love." The mountains all were calling, and the oak trees answering, "Oh, woe, woe for Adonis, he is dead." And Echo cried in answer, "Oh, woe, woe for Adonis," and all the Loves wept for him, and all the Muses too. But down in the black underworld, Adonis could not hear them, nor see the crimson flower that sprang up where each drop of his blood had stained the earth. Part 2. Stories of Love and Adventure. Chapter 5. Cupid and Psyche. This story is told only by Apuleius, a Latin writer of the 2nd century AD. The Latin names of the gods are therefore used. It is a prettily told tale, after the manner of Ovid. The writer is entertained by what he writes. He believes none of it. There was once a king who had 3 daughters, all lovely maidens, but the youngest, Psyche, excelled her sisters so greatly that beside them she seemed a very goddess consorting with mere mortals. The fame of her surpassing beauty spread over the earth, and everywhere men journeyed to gaze upon her with wonder and adoration, and to do her homage, as though she were in truth one of the immortals. They would even say that Venus herself could not equal this mortal. As they thronged in ever-growing numbers to worship her loveliness, no one any more gave a thought to Venus herself. Her temples were neglected, her altars foul with cold ashes, her favorite towns deserted and falling in ruins. All the honors once hers were now given to a mere girl destined someday to die. It may well be believed that the goddess would not put up with this treatment. As always, when she was in trouble, she turned for help to her son, that beautiful winged youth whom some call Cupid and others Love, against whose arrows there is no defense, neither in heaven nor on the earth. She told him her wrongs, and as always he was ready to do her bidding. "Use your power," she said, "and make the hussy fall madly in love with the vilest and most despicable creature there is in the whole world." And so, no doubt, he would have done, if Venus had not first shown him Psyche, never thinking in her jealous rage what such beauty might do, even to the god of love himself. As he looked upon her, it was as if he had shot one of his arrows into his own heart. He said nothing to his mother. Indeed, he had no power to utter a word, and Venus left him with the happy confidence that he would swiftly bring about Psyche's ruin. What happened, however, was not what she had counted on. Psyche did not fall in love with a horrible wretch. She did not fall in love at all. Still more strange, no one fell in love with her. Men were content to look and wonder and worship, and then pass on to marry someone else. Both her sisters, inexpressibly inferior to her, were splendidly married, each to a king. Psyche, the all-beautiful, sat sad and solitary, only admired, never loved. It seemed that no man wanted her. This was, of course, most disturbing to her parents. Her father finally traveled to an oracle of Apollo to ask his advice on how to get her a good husband. The god answered him, but his words were terrible. Cupid had told him the whole story and had begged for his help. Accordingly, Apollo said that Psyche, dressed in deepest mourning, must be set on the summit of a rocky hill and left alone, and that there her destined husband, a fearful winged serpent, stronger than the gods themselves, would come to her and make her his wife. The misery of all when Psyche's father brought back this lamentable news can be imagined. They dressed the maiden as though for her death, and carried her to the hill with greater sorrowing than if it had been to her tomb. But Psyche herself kept her courage. "You should have wept for me before," she told them, "because of the beauty that has drawn down upon me the jealousy of heaven. Now go, knowing that I am glad the end has come." They went in despairing grief, leaving the lovely, helpless creature to meet her doom alone, and they shut themselves in their palace to mourn all their days for her. On the high hilltop in the darkness, Psyche sat, waiting for she knew not what terror. There, as she wept and trembled, a soft breath of air came through the stillness to her, the gentle breathing of Zephyr, sweetest and mildest of winds. She felt it lift her up. She was floating away from the rocky hill, and down, until she lay upon a grassy meadow, soft as a bed, and fragrant with flowers. It was so peaceful there. All her trouble left her, and she slept. She woke beside a bright river, and on its bank was a mansion, stately and beautiful, as though built for a god, with pillars of gold and walls of silver and floors inlaid with precious stones. No sound was to be heard. The place seemed deserted, and Psyche drew near, awestruck at the sight of such splendor. As she hesitated on the threshold, voices sounded in her ear. She could see no one, but the words they spoke came clearly to her. The house was for her, they told her. She must enter without fear and bathe and refresh herself. Then a banquet table would be spread for her. We are your servants, the voices said, ready to do whatever you desire. The bath was the most delightful, the food the most delicious she had ever enjoyed. While she dined, sweet music breathed around her. A great choir seemed to sing to a harp, but she could only hear, not see them. Throughout the day, except for the strange companionship of the voices, she was alone. But in some inexplicable way, she felt sure that with the coming of the night, her husband would be with her. And so it happened. When she felt him beside her and heard his voice softly murmuring in her ear, all her fears left her. She knew without seeing him that here was no monster or shape of terror, but the lover and husband she had longed and waited for. This half-and-half companionship could not fully content her. Still, she was happy and the time passed swiftly. One night, however, her dear though unseen husband spoke gravely to her and warned her that danger in the shape of her two sisters was approaching. They are coming to the hill where you disappeared to weep for you, he said, but you must not let them see you, or you will bring great sorrow upon me and ruin to yourself. She promised him she would not. But all the next day she passed in weeping, thinking of her sisters and herself unable to comfort them. She was still in tears when her husband came, and even his caresses could not check them. At last he yielded, sorrowfully, to her great desire. Do what you will, he said, but you are seeking your own destruction. Then he warned her solemnly not to be persuaded by anyone to try to see him, on pain of being separated from him forever. Psyche cried out that she would never do so. She would die 100 times over rather than live without him. But give me this joy, she said, to see my sisters. Sadly, he promised her that it should be so. The next morning, the two came, brought down from the mountain by Zephyr. Happy and excited, Psyche was waiting for them. It was long before the three could speak to each other. Their joy was too great to be expressed except by tears and embraces. But when at last they entered the palace and the elder sisters saw its surpassing treasures, when they sat at the rich banquet and heard the marvelous music, bitter envy took possession of them and a devouring curiosity as to who was the lord of all this magnificence and their sister's husband. But Psyche kept faith. She told them only that he was a young man, away now on a hunting expedition. Then, filling their hands with gold and jewels, she had Zephyr bear them back to the hill. They went willingly enough, but their hearts were on fire with jealousy. All their own wealth and good fortune seemed to them as nothing compared with Psyche's, and their envious anger so worked in them that they came finally to plotting how to ruin her. That very night, Psyche's husband warned her once more. She would not listen when he begged her not to let them come again. She never could see him, she reminded him. Was she also to be forbidden to see all others, even her sisters, so dear to her? He yielded, as before, and very soon the two wicked women arrived, with their plot carefully worked out. Already, because of Psyche's stumbling and contradictory answers when they asked her what her husband looked like, they had become convinced that she had never set eyes on him and did not really know what he was. They did not tell her this, but they reproached her for hiding her terrible state from them, her own sisters. They had learned, they said, and knew for a fact, that her husband was not a man, but the fearful serpent Apollo's oracle had declared he would be. He was kind now, no doubt, but he would certainly turn upon her some night and devour her. Psyche, aghast, felt terror flooding her heart instead of love. She had wondered so often why he would never let her see him. There must be some dreadful reason. What did she really know about him? If he was not horrible to look at, then he was cruel to forbid her ever to behold him. In extreme misery, faltering and stammering, she gave her sisters to understand that she could not deny what they said, because she had been with him only in the dark. "There must be something very wrong," she sobbed, "for him so to shun the light of day." And she begged them to advise her. They had their advice all prepared beforehand. That night, she must hide a sharp knife and a lamp near her bed. When her husband was fast asleep, she must leave the bed, light the lamp, and get the knife. She must steel herself to plunge it swiftly into the body of the frightful being the light would certainly show her. "We will be near," they said, "and carry you away with us when he is dead." Then they left her, torn by doubt and distracted what to do. She loved him. He was her dear husband. No, he was a horrible serpent, and she loathed him. She would kill him. She would not. She must have certainty. She did not want certainty. So all day long her thoughts fought with each other. When evening came, however, she had given the struggle up. One thing she was determined to do: she would see him. When at last he lay sleeping quietly, she summoned all her courage and lit the lamp. She tiptoed to the bed, and holding the light high above her, she gazed at what lay there. Oh, the relief and the rapture that filled her heart! No monster was revealed, but the sweetest and fairest of all creatures, at whose sight the very lamp seemed to shine brighter. In her first shame at her folly and lack of faith, Psyche fell on her knees and would have plunged the knife into her own breast if it had not fallen from her trembling hands. But those same unsteady hands that saved her betrayed her too. For as she hung over him, ravished at the sight of him, and unable to deny herself the bliss of filling her eyes with his beauty, some hot oil fell from the lamp upon his shoulder. He started awake. He saw the light, and knew her faithlessness, and without a word, he fled from her. She rushed out after him into the night. She could not see him, but she heard his voice speaking to her. He told her who he was, and sadly bade her farewell. "Love cannot live where there is no trust," he said, and flew away. "The god of love," she thought, "he was my husband, and I, wretch that I am, could not keep faith with him. Is he gone from me forever? At any rate," she told herself with rising courage, "I can spend the rest of my life searching for him. If he has no more love left for me, at least I can show him how much I love him." And she started on her journey. She had no idea where to go. She knew only that she would never give up looking for him. He, meanwhile, had gone to his mother's chamber to have his wound cared for. But when Venus heard his story and learned that it was Psyche whom he had chosen, she left him angrily alone in his pain, and went forth to find the girl of whom he had made her still more jealous. Venus was determined to show Psyche what it meant to draw down the displeasure of a goddess. Poor Psyche, in her despairing wanderings, was trying to win the gods over to her side. She offered ardent prayers to them perpetually, but not one of them would do anything to make Venus their enemy. At last, she perceived that there was no hope for her, either in heaven or on earth, and she took a desperate resolve. She would go straight to Venus. She would offer herself humbly to her as her servant and try to soften her anger. And who knows, she thought, if he himself is not there in his mother's house. So she set